20. They'd shifted through space so smoothly that Aliza hadn't even realized they'd left the chaotic avenue until they materialized a moment later in the middle of an expansive flower field. Neither had she realized she was silently crying, not until she felt the wet of Cyrus's sweater under her cheek. With painstaking care, he let go of her, drawing away in cautious movements, before helping her to the ground, where she sank with a grateful sigh for only a moment, before tipping slowly over. She curled onto her side, crushing a bed of tulips under her body, and experiencing all the while a physical reaction she didn't understand. Her limbs felt dead and leaden. She was colder than she'd ever been, more exhausted than she'd ever felt, and her head seemed impossible to hold upright. Her numb fingers could hardly manage to unclasp the heavy collar from around her neck, which felt now like it was choking her, and with a final exhausting effort, she tore it away from her throat and tossed the glittering piece to the ground. She took a deep, shaky breath. Aliza could still feel those people. She still heard their voices, her lungs compressing under the weight of their hopes, her ribs cracking under the heft of their dreams. She'd never longed for her parents more than she did in that very moment, wishing for guidance, for someone to tell her that she was strong enough, that she was worthy, that she should rise now more than ever, that she would not fail if she did. "Aliza," he whispered, "you're scaring me." She heard his familiar voice and opened her eyes at the sound, searching for his face. Instead, everywhere she looked were flowers. She smelled grass, the welcome scent of overturned soil, the freshness of dew. Her wet cheek was pressed against the velvet petals of many tulips. A trio of bees were buzzing near her nose. She felt she might live here forever, might rest her weary head upon this flower bed and pretend, for a moment, that she was still a child. "Please," said Cyrus, "at least tell me you're okay." "I'm afraid that's impossible," she said, sniffing softly. She closed her eyes again, let the flowers dry her tears. "What do you mean?" he said, alarmed. "Why impossible?" "Well," she said, "because I've recently deduced that you're quite charmingly pathetic." He sighed. "Really? You're choosing this moment to insult me?" "And I have a theory," she went on, "that if I were badly wounded, you would help me." "True or false?" He went silent. He was silent so long, Aliza had time enough to watch a drop of dew drip off a glossy green leaf. "True or false, Cyrus?" She heard his uneven exhale, the raw edge to his voice when he said, irritably, "False." The nostril flashed cold. "Liar," she whispered. "I don't care for this game." "Where are we, by the way?" she asked, her eyes landing on a particularly purple tulip, the colour so vivid it seemed imagined. In response, Cyrus did not say what was obvious, which was that they were in a flower field. Instead, he answered the more specific question she'd failed to ask, and said simply, "Somewhere safe." "Safe?" she said, managing a small smile. "Even with you here?" It was a moment before he said, quietly, "Yes." The nostril warmed. Aliza still hadn't seen him. She couldn't see him. The tulips were tall, her head was heavy, and she felt no inclination to move. She wondered whether Cyrus was sitting just to the side of her, and tried to picture him, in his austere black clothes, perched in a sea of flowers, his long legs pulled up to his chest, like a boy. His hair, she thought, would look very nice against all the green. "And is there magic here too?" she asked.
"Yes."
Aliza reached a tired hand toward a wilted bloom, stroking its broken neck and sleepy petals, and the flower wriggled under her touch, straining to stand upright. She realized then that the blooms would pop straight back up once she left.
"Someone would have to walk for miles to find you here," he said, answering another question she hadn't asked. "There's no direct path to this field."
"Then what purpose does it serve?"
"What do you mean?"
"The flower field," she said. "I don't think it's a wild field, for it seems planted intentionally. But you say there's no way to access it. And if it's been enchanted to bloom always, I have to assume the stems aren't meant to be sold at market. So why is it here? Who put it here?"
"The field exists simply to exist. There are thousands of different types of flowers here," he explained. "It's meant to be a kind of living painting, an experience with beauty meant to invigorate the tired senses."
Aliza nearly lifted her head. She was so surprised. "That's why you brought me here?"
"Yes," he said quietly.
"You mean you were trying to console me?"
"Bloody hell, Aliza, knock it off!"
"All right, okay," she said with a sigh.
"Good."
"Me," she said again. "You were trying to console me."
"You know what? You can walk back to the castle."
I'm sorry. I promise I'm really done this time." She bit the inside of her cheek, and then, very, very softly, she said, "I do hope you know how grateful I am that you brought me here. It's absolutely beautiful."
"Yes, well," he said, taking a sharp breath. "You strike me as precisely the sort of maudlin person who would appreciate the company of flowers while crying."
She sat with that for a moment, trying to decode it. "Do you know," she said finally, "I think that might be the nicest thing you've ever said to me."
"It wasn't a compliment."
"Yes," she said, smiling. "I think it was." He laughed quietly at that, and she did too, and the two of them fell into a companionable silence, studiously avoiding the most obvious topic of conversation. Aliza didn't know what Cyrus was doing where he sat, but if he had any idea how ardently she was now mulling over the prospect of taking over his empire, he said nothing about it. Aliza, for her part, was tickling the stems of tired flowers, watching them squirm while she deliberated. She was grateful for the moment of quiet, for her mind was a distorted mess. If ever she doubted her place in the world before, she knew now, unequivocally, that there were people waiting for her, people who would follow her, and to whom she was tethered by birth and fate, duty-bound to lead and unify. And yet, for years, this had seemed impossible. It had been easy to tell herself that she could do nothing about so large a problem when she lacked a crown to make her queen, an empire over which to rule, and resources to help her people. But now, how could she willingly walk away from her responsibilities when an easy answer was sitting right there next to her, offering up his castle, his title, his land, and his people? She'd be a fool to say no. Then again, the obvious answer to so many of her problems was also entangled in the wishes of Iblis, who'd orchestrated this circus from its inception. He'd likely nudged her into this exact moment through devious means, having found ways to bend her emotions to his will without ever saying a word. Her parents had once warned her that her heart, if tuned precisely to compassion, would become a two-pronged tool. It would be her greatest strength and her greatest weakness. She'd never really understood what they'd meant, for it had been difficult to imagine how empathy, so necessary in an emotional arsenal, might prove a weapon of destruction. But now she knew. Now it was clear to her that the devil, who was a master of pinpointing and exploiting a person's greatest weakness, had struck her target straight and true, and would use her compassion against her until she broke. What would happen, she wondered, if she accepted Cyrus's proposal, if she fulfilled her destiny? How might the devil intervene? She sighed, and the sound carried, awakening a rustle of movement in her neighbour. Cyrus, she said softly.
Yes?
Can I ask you a question? She could almost feel him stiffen in response.
I'd really rather you didn't.
Yes, I realise that. But may I ask anyway? He sighed. Why do you always wear black? She said. It doesn't suit your colouring at all.
Pass.
You're not going to answer, said Aliza, taken aback. But it's such a gentle question.
Oh, and you have less gentle questions for me, do you?
He didn't sound happy about it. A great deal, in fact.
Once again, I'll pass.
Cyrus, she said patiently, you can't just ask a girl to marry you and then decline to answer a single question about yourself.
Try me.
Fine. Do you have any brothers or sisters? He cleared his throat and said quietly,
pass.
You do have siblings? Really?
Next question.
She hesitated, feeling dejected, and resolved to ask him something a bit meaner. All right, then. Maybe you can explain to me why the people of Tulan don't seem to hate you.
Hate me? He laughed at that. Why should they hate me?
You're surprised, she said, more a statement than question. That's interesting. But you took the throne in such a bloody violent manner. It was in fact so brutal a takeover, it was talked about all over the world. There was also a great deal of speculation as to your mental state and your ability to rule.
I was not the first in history to claim a crown in an unsavoury manner, he said coldly. And I will not be the last. In the end, citizens care most about clean water, fair wages, good harvests, and a carefully managed treasury. I take care of my people. I give them no reason to hate me.
But people in Ardunia really seem to hate you, she pointed out quietly. A lot. He laughed again, this time with some anger.
They hate me only because they fear me.
Should they fear you?
Yes.
The Noster warmed at that, and Aliza's heart beat a little faster. Very well, she said, bracing herself. I'm going to ask you possibly the harshest question now.
What?
He said sharply. Aliza held her breath and waited, just until she heard him sigh. Gently, he said,
what is it?
Was your father... was he a terrible man? Is that why you killed him? Cyrus fell silent for so long that the sounds of the world around them came into brighter focus. The hush of a restless wind grew fiercer. The chirps of busy birds grew louder. Flowers swayed as clouds parted and passed, making paths for the setting sun to glimmer through leaves and branches, dappling all in a heavy golden light. She heard crickets and bees, parted her lips to draw breath, tasted the chill before it pressed against her skin. Most of all, she could hear him breathing. Cyrus, she said finally, will you not answer me?
I don't want to talk about my father, but I won't discuss it.
How am I supposed to trust you, she said, if I can't understand why you did such a gruesome thing?
You don't have to trust me.
Of course I do, she frowned. You're making me enormous promises, and I have to believe that you mean them, that you'll fulfill your end of the bargain.
I'll make you a blood oath.
Aliza went very, very still.
No, she said, exhaling the word.
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because, Cyrus...
If you kill me as we've agreed, none of it will matter.
But you'll be bound to me, possibly forever.
Only if you don't kill me.
And until then?
He took a deep breath. Well, yes. Until then it'll be fairly uncomfortable. Mostly for me.
She shook her head against the flowers. I won't do it. It's not humane. You'll have no free will.
He laughed bitterly. And I suppose you think killing me is the more humane option?
Killing you was your idea.
This too is my idea. I don't see why you're being so obstinate.
Why won't you just tell me your reasons? She countered, frustrated. Your mother said you did it because you claimed your father wasn't fit to rule. Is that true?
My mother, he said stiffly, talks too much.
Cyrus.
He stood up without warning, and Aliza saw him come into view with a start, as if she were seeing him for the first time. She turned slowly until she was no longer on her side, but on her back, her curls catching loose corollas as she moved, her motions sending into chaos a tiptoe of tulips. She picked a loose petal off her cheek and stared up at him through a kaleidoscope of colour and stems and leaves, and for a moment she saw nothing but sky and the blue of his eyes. Then his hair, gleaming in the dying light, the elegant lines of his face, gilded by the golden hour. Aliza did not like to admit to his beauty, which was hard enough to deny under ordinary conditions, but here, standing in an ocean of flowers, tall and sombre in his simple black clothes, Cyrus was fairly magnificent. He was looking at nothing in particular, his body turned away from hers, but the tension in his limbs and the rigidity in his stance belied the placid look on his face. Softly, she called his name. He turned his head, saw her there, and visibly flinched. Of all the things Aliza thought she might find in his gaze, she hadn't expected fear. She watched his throat work as he looked at her, taking in every inch of her languid body with care. His eyes lingered in places, darkening with something she'd come to recognize as hunger. He regarded her then with an expression that came dangerously close to weakness, as if he couldn't decide which part of her to savour longest, and his attentions, so intense, made her feel both desperate and unsteady, like she couldn't breathe. You took off your necklace, he said with some difficulty.
Yes.
Why?
I felt it was choking me.
Right, he said, and dragged a hand down his face. Abruptly he turned away.
Cyrus, she said after a moment. Are you afraid of me?
He almost laughed then, but his expression was strained. What an absurd question.
Will you answer it anyway?
No, he said dryly. I'm not afraid of you.
The noster went cold. You are, she insisted. You think I'm going to hurt you?
No, I don't. Again the noster went cold.
Cyrus,
stop! He was breathing harder than usual. I don't want to talk any more.
But... He made a sound, something like a hiss, his eyes squeezing shut as his body seized without provocation. He clutched his torso and doubled over, clenching his teeth as he sank slowly to his knees, and as he fell forward on his hands, he gasped, then bit back a cry, and Aliza, who was watching this unfold with increasing horror, realized that Cyrus was trying not to scream. She forgot herself. She forgot her own tired body and shot upright in fear, her head swimming only a little as she stumbled, steadying herself as she rushed toward him. "What's happening?" she said, stricken. "Why are you hurting? Let me..." She touched him, and he jerked away, forcing out a single word. "Don't!"
"But..."
Cyrus's head shot back in a sudden violent motion, his eyes going wide as he paled, his skin taking on an ashen, sickly colour. His body trembled, his chest heaving as he breathed faster and faster, his face all the while frozen in a single horrified expression. She knew then that he was seeing something, that he was hearing something.
"No!"
he shouted.
"No!"
He broke then, broke with an agonized sound as he collapsed forward, his shoulders shaking as he gasped for breath.
"I can't," he said desperately. "I can't. I'm sorry. Please."
Aliza bore witness to the torture in his eyes. She heard the low, keening sound he made as a single tear, then another, tracked slowly down his cheek. She thought her heart might fail. She understood rationally that Cyrus was guilty of bringing the devil into his own life, but she didn't know how to turn away from the suffering of others. She stood there and watched, horrified, while he begged blindly for mercy, as he flinched over and over like he'd been struck. Soon, a thin line of blood began dripping slowly from the crown of his head, then his nose. Cyrus wept. He pleaded even as he suffered, blood dripping into his open mouth as he spoke.
"Not the other one," he gasped. "Please, I'm begging you, don't take the other one."
Cyrus would have died before exposing himself like this. Aliza knew this, knew he would have willingly thrown himself off a cliff before betraying such emotion before her. And yet here he was, laid bare at her feet, entirely against his will. She knew the mastermind behind this misery, and she suspected the devil was humiliating Cyrus on purpose, destroying him before her as a form of punishment, stealing from him his pride in the process, his privacy. She tried to avert her eyes, but how could she, when her pathetic heart snapped in half at the sight? She was panicked, powerless in the face of his anguish, wishing stupidly that she might wrench him free from this trance, even as she knew any effort would be futile. For when Iblis invaded a mind, escape was impossible. No, Aliza knew better. She was not naive. She understood that this episode had been orchestrated for her benefit. Iblis was torturing Cyrus in an effort to manipulate her sympathies. She saw her missteps quite clearly then, and with increasing despair, realized that she'd somehow betrayed herself. She'd started to like Cyrus. She'd begun to see him with complexity, with compassion. She did not, in fact, want to kill him. He was no longer a one-dimensional monster to her, but a perplexing character she hoped to understand. She'd given Iblis this ammunition. Indeed, Aliza suspected she could put an end to this torment right now if she said but one word. "Yes. Yes, I'll marry him." Oh, she was tempted. She'd been deliberating over the choice all day, and she'd felt herself leaning toward an answer in the affirmative more in every hour. But if she allowed herself in this moment to be strong-armed into making such an important decision, she'd only be proving to Iblis that her emotions could in fact be controlled by such dark tactics, and then he might never stop. Aliza couldn't set such a dangerous precedent. Certainly not now, when it was clearer than ever what misery she might face if she accepted Cyrus's offer. Her only hope of unifying her people came with a steep price. Marrying Cyrus would lead her directly into the devil's arms, and she'd have to maintain a steely resolve in order to tread such treacherous waters. If she did not stand her ground now, where would this manipulation end? How many others would suffer? How many more lives would Iblis break before her in the pursuit of bending her will? She released a shaky breath. She could have prevented this. If only she'd been more guarded. If only she hadn't cared. If only Cyrus hadn't turned out to be so very, very human. Slowly, Aliza fell to her knees. She took Cyrus's limp hand in hers, and, like a fool, she cried for him. 21. On perhaps any other evening, a previous version of Kamran might have complained aloud at the inconvenience of changing for dinner, for it had always seemed to him a senseless tradition. As a young prince, he'd managed to avoid such rituals more often than not, for Zal had been indulgent of his grandson, who'd once loudly insisted that he couldn't imagine the use in changing his clothes merely to eat a meal. He'd considered himself too practical for such nonsense. In fact, just days ago, he might have made some snide remark to his solemn valet about the waste of time, waste of fabric, waste of jewels. He'd thought himself above such frivolity, as he'd often described it. What was the point, he'd wondered, in such elaborate ensembles? What purpose did they serve? For 18 years, Kamran had been a fool. A single day his grandfather had been gone, and already Kamran was beginning to understand that the hours the late king had spent in his dressing room were far from frivolous. In fact, they were a small mercy. While Kamran was being dressed, he could not be bothered. He was not asked to speak. He could not be questioned. There were no ministers to harangue him, no military manoeuvres to put forth, no rivals to destroy. The enforced quiet was unexpectedly calming, the ritual requiring of him only to remain still, allowing his mind to prepare for the trials ahead. The clothes, too, were a gift. Each layer like a bandage wrapped around his vulnerable body. He welcomed the weight. The heavier the pieces, the steadier he felt, the better armoured for the hours he would endure, the physical and mental blows he would no doubt sustain. Kamran even had the presence of mind to realise that this quiet window in the company of his unobtrusive valet might be his last for a long while. He would savour it. In any case, the prince's mind required silence to spin, for his apprehensions were tripling by the moment. He'd been unable to deduce Zahak's intentions in his grandfather's rooms, and the unsolved mystery had left him uneasy. The problem was, Kamran had never been intimate enough with the late king's personal effects to know whether anything had been disturbed or rearranged. As far as he could tell, all was as it should have been, the glittering quarters as meticulous as always. And while some part of him knew he ought to have conducted a more thorough search, he'd lacked the fortitude to linger in the space any longer than was absolutely necessary. It had been too soon. His grandfather's scent had hung in the air, not unlike a likeness of the man himself. His imagined form had been conjured from only sense and sensation. So powerful was this force that Kamran half expected Zal to walk into the room at any moment, scolding him for the intrusion. Kamran had struggled to be surrounded by such potent memories. His chest had ached as he toured the museum of his grandfather's life. The experience had affected him a great deal more than he cared to admit, for it betrayed a weakness in his character, a weakness of which his grandfather would have deeply disapproved. The prince closed his eyes on an exhale then, Zal's painful words reanimating unbidden in his mind.
"Enough!"
his grandfather said angrily, his voice rising an octave.
"You accuse me of things you do not understand, child. The decisions I've had to make during my reign, the things I've had to do to protect the throne, would be enough to fuel your nightmares for an eternity. My, what joys lie ahead." "You dare jest," the king said darkly. "You astonish me. Never once have I led you to believe that ruling an empire would be easy, or for even a moment, enjoyable. Indeed, if it does not kill you first, the crown will do its utmost to claim you, body and soul. This kingdom could never be ruled by the weak of heart. It is up to you alone to find the strength necessary to survive." "And is that what you think of me, your highness? You think me weak of heart?" "Yes."
Kamran's eyes flew open. He felt his hands tremble and quickly curled them into fists, struggling to restore his confidence. Kamran liked to think of himself as a powerful, invulnerable force, but a single look at the last week of his life was enough to prove the truth. He was too easily ruled by his heart, too easily manipulated by his emotions. He was, in fact, weak. The realization made him nauseous, a wave of self-loathing roiling in his gut. Kamran had been better in command of himself when he was distracted, when Hazan demanded from him a sharpness of mind and wit, when he was moving fast and making plans. But in the wake of Hazan's and Omid's departures, and after he'd dispatched a letter to his aunt, he'd spent the better part of the afternoon evading the stammering servants intent on delivering him hand-printed notes from Zahak, all of which requested his immediate presence in one of the grand parlours. Instead, Kamran had made himself scarce. He'd flit from one darkened corner to another as a silver sea of diviners slowly infiltrated his home, their long liquid metal robes skimming the floor as they moved, the trained motions of their feet so unnatural they only ever appeared to glide. He'd felt them as they arrived, each new presence striking him like a tap against a tuning fork, a low-level hum of electricity buzzing along the distorted gold veins of his body. It had frightened him, and like a child, he'd fled. Kamran knew that a meeting with the nobles and diviners would be explosive and absolute, for they owed him answers he was not yet ready to receive. There was more work he wanted to do before he was paraded before the priests and priestesses like a sick horse, assessed for worthiness and found wanting. He didn't want to hear them declare him unfit to rule. He didn't wish to be sentenced to a distant province where he might live in an old dilapidated holding of the crown, accompanied by a brooding cook, a miserable maid, and an unhappy valet, none of whom would have willingly left Satar to keep him company. He was not yet ready for his entire life to change. Instead, Kamran had pored over the enigmatic Book of Arya, which he kept clutched in one hand even now, loath to part with this essential piece of an enigmatic puzzle. Over and over he tried to get the book to give up its secrets, studying its skin for more hidden symbols, and pressing a pen to its pages without success, the paper proving impervious to ink. When he'd tired of that, he'd filched food from the kitchens, filled skins of water, stocked empty crates with supplies they'd need for their week-long journey, all of which he'd then hidden carefully near the stables. The prince only deigned to dress for dinner in the interest of upholding a veneer of the status quo. For though he'd no intention of sitting down to a formal meal, he figured he might, at the very least, pretend to make an appearance before surreptitiously ducking out. Night had fallen upon Sitar like a stroke of tar, and he meant to use the darkness to his advantage, for he still had to haul the hidden crates down to the dock.
"Thank you, Suna," he said quietly.
The valet drew back and bowed, straightening before saying,
"As a reminder, sire, your cloak awaits you in your bedroom."
Kamran turned carefully to face the man. There was no reason Sina should suspect the prince of needing his cloak, for he'd done nothing to betray his intentions of leaving the castle at this hour.
"I shouldn't require my cloak," he said quietly, "if I'm only going down to dinner."
"Of course, sire."
Sina lowered his eyes.
"It's only that earlier,
one of the diviners saw me passing in the hall and she bid me remind you that your cloak is hanging in your bedroom."
Kamran stiffened.
"Why would she say such a thing to you?"
"Forgive me, your highness," Sina said, shaking his head. "I don't know."
Kamran's heart was pounding in his chest now. Once again, he seemed to feel the electric hum of the diviner's presence, feel its spark along the glittering branches disfiguring his left arm. He didn't know what this new sensation meant, but he suspected that whatever it wasn't good.
"You may go," he said.
Sina retreated with another bow and without a sound, after which Kamran charged into his room, retrieved his hooded cloak from its hook, and stormed the halls of his own home. He was perturbed. Too many disturbing revelations and unanswered questions had finally unravelled his mind enough that it seemed, sometimes, like he was little more than a mess of nerves. He felt powerless in the face of so much uncertainty, and inaction made him uneasy. He felt he must do something or combust, and this was his sole thought as he flew down the grand staircase, heaving the cape around his shoulders as he went, the superfine black wool billowing about him like a pair of wings. He fastened the heavy gold latch at his throat before making certain the Book of Aria was tucked safely into his cloak, then assessed his escape options. He was determined to make an undetected exit from the palace and was just reaching for the chainmail mask in his pocket when he heard the distant echoing sound of Omid's voice. Omid, who'd failed him. Night had fallen an hour ago, and the child had only now returned? Inwardly, Kamran sighed. He was going out to the stables anyway. He figured he may as well track down Omid and take him along, assign him a new role, make the necessary introductions to the groom. Not only would this give him an excellent pretense for leaving the grounds wearing his cloak, but Omid would then become someone else's charge, making him one less responsibility Kamran need worry about in his absence. Resolved, the prince followed the muted resonance of the boy's voice, noting as he drew closer to the source that even from this distance, Omid appeared to be deeply agitated. Kamran frowned. The boy was not in fact speaking. He was arguing, exchanging frustrations with what sounded like an angry footman. And no wonder. Omid was shouting in Feshtun, clearly oblivious to the fact that most footmen in Sitar would not be educated enough to speak the language of his southern province.
Kamran picked up his pace then, striding impatiently toward the front hall, intending to resolve the matter at once, when he heard something altogether more upsetting. Miss Huda. Her voice was unmistakable, and Kamran experienced a spike of alarm at the sound. He could neither imagine why Miss Huda had returned to the palace at this hour, nor what she was doing in Omid's company, but the young woman was now screeching at the angry footman, her shouts growing only more shrill as she cried, "I most certainly will not step aside, and don't you dare touch me!" "Miss, please, you're not allowed to be here. This is a private hour for the royal household. The prince does not receive unsolicited guests in the evening." "But she's with me," Omid said in accented Ardans, before giving up and carrying on in his native tongue. "We're here on official orders for the prince. You must let us pass." "Are you making any sense of this?" said a footman. "I can't understand a word he's saying."
"What he's saying," Miss Huda interjected angrily, "is that we are here by order of the prince himself. And mark my words, my father, the Logian ambassador, will be hearing about this."
Kamran thought his head might explode. The audacity of this absurd young woman to invoke his name in the interest of her own immunity. Oh, he was already pitying himself for being forced to endure her company for the second time in the same day. He turned the corner too sharply, wishing he might leave these idiots to their fate, when suddenly the entire abhorrent scene came into view. Kamran stopped short, his body going slack in disbelief. 22. Omid and Miss Huda stood centre stage, both tall and too proud in equally awful ill-fitting attire, shouting in different languages at a trio of stubborn footmen. In the wings stood Dean, the wiry apothecarist, and Mrs. Amina, the brutal housekeeper of Ba's house. This unlikely duo stood silently side by side, each with a hand clapped over their mouths, in horror. Angels above. Kamran had given the boy a single task. He charged Omid with bringing in the apothecarist and the housekeeper for a round of questioning. After Miss Huda's unexpected arrival at the palace this morning, he'd been inspired to interview all others who'd known or conversed with Aliza at length, and though Kamran had spoken once briefly with the apothecarist while incognito, he'd intended to ask the man more direct questions this time around. Now he knew nothing but regret. "I'm sorry, miss," said a footman who didn't sound sorry at all. "I can't let you pass. I have no idea who this boy is," he nodded to Omid, "and I don't care who your father is. So unless you're hoping to land yourself in prison tonight, step aside." Miss Huda reared back, clasping a hand to her chest with no small amount of drama. "How dare you!"
"This is your final warning," said another footman.
"Oh, just you wait," she said, drawing herself up to her full height. "Just wait until I speak to the prince about this. My associate and I are here on royal orders."
"Your associate?"
Kamran said sharply, emerging from the shadows.
"Your Highness!"
cried a chorus of breathless voices. All bowed and scraped before him in an almost choreographed motion, all but Omid, the boy peeling off from the crowd to approach Kamran with wild eyes, his head shaking hard as he spoke in rapid-fire Feshtun.
"I swear I would have been here before nightfall, sire. I swear with my whole heart I would have. I brought them just as you asked, except there was a mob gathered outside the palace gates."
"A mob?"
"Yes, sire. The people are very angry, sire, and the guards were threatening to pull up the drawbridge to prevent anyone from coming through. until Miss Hooda told them who she was. And finally we did get through the gates. But then they wouldn't let us come through the front door because they said you weren't accepting visitors. But then we finally got through the door and then they...
Enough!
Kamran said. Omid bit his lip and slunk back, looking suddenly like he might cry. The prince ignored this, his mind in chaos. He'd suspected the people would riot, so it wasn't a surprise exactly to hear that a mob had assembled, but it was devastating nonetheless. Solemnly he nodded at the footman.
You may go.
But, sire...
Ha! Cried Miss Hooda, jabbing a finger at the trio of young men. I told you that you'd be sorry.
If I hear you say another word, Kamran said quietly, his eyes flashing, I will have you barred forevermore from the palace.
Miss Hooda fell back, two spots of pink appearing high on her cheekbones. Kamran took a steadying breath, struggling to rein in his anger, his frustration, his myriad disappointments. He turned to the footmen, acknowledging them one by one.
Thank you for your efforts. I'll take it from here. Yes, sire.
As you wish, sire. And then they were gone. Finally, Kamran was left no choice but to face his strange audience, the odd group staring at him now with terror. The prince knew he'd no one but himself to blame for this shameful turn of events, and wasn't sure then whether his anger was aimed more at himself, or Omid, or perhaps even the infuriating Miss Hooda. Quietly, he said, Someone explain to me at once what is going on here before I have the lot of you carted off to the dungeons.
Omid and Miss Hooda, so loud only minutes before, seemed incapable then of saying a word. Their mouths opened and closed as they shared frightened, uncertain glances, and Kamran thought he really might lose his mind when finally Dean stepped forward and broke open the silence.
If I may, Your Highness, he cleared his throat. I'd only like to say that I too would love to know what is going on here, for I haven't the faintest idea.
Kamran raised his eyebrows.
How is that possible? All I know, sire, is that the ruination of my day began when this young woman,
Dean nodded at Miss Hooda,
barreled into my shop, about 4 hours ago, and without warning or even an introduction, began interrogating me, in front of my customers, no less, about someone I'd treated days ago, demanding all the while that I divulge confidential information to a complete stranger, which I feel I should point out is not only unethical but illegal, and I was still trying to get the miss to leave the premises when this absurdly tall child, he pointed at Omid, barged into my store for the second time today, and this time demanded I follow him back to the palace, or else hang at dawn for defying an order from the crown.
Kamran made a pained sound.
And then these two hooligans,
Dean gestured vaguely at Miss Hooda and Omid,
forged some spontaneous and no doubt nefarious alliance, after which they forced me into the back of a foul rented hackney, where I was made to wait at least 45 minutes before I was suddenly thrust into the very unpleasant company of the woman standing beside me now. I'm afraid I don't know her name.
He turned to Mrs. Amina and muttered an apology, which she ignored with a scowl.
But she spent the entire ride moaning about how angry her mistress would be upon discovering she'd gone, for her mistress was in terrible spirits and she couldn't be spared, especially not on such short notice. All right,
Kamran said flatly.
I think I've heard enough.
Dean nodded, then stepped back. The prince was about to send the witnesses home, fire Omid on the spot, and bar Miss Hooda from the palace grounds on principle, when Mrs. Amina suddenly cleared her throat.
I'd like to say a word too, sire,
if I may.
Kamran studied the woman, her beady eyes, her small nose, her ruddy cheeks, and couldn't help but feel a note of revulsion, even now. He'd never forget the bruises he'd seen on Aliza's face, the threat of brutality this housekeeper had unleashed before his very eyes. Mrs. Amina was a cruel woman.
"You may speak," he said, watching her closely.
"Thank you, Your Highness," she said haltingly. "First, I'll preface this by saying that I realise now might not be the best moment to say my piece, but I feel I might never have another opportunity to stand before you, sire, and clear my name. And so I will say now in my own defence that when you last came to visit your good aunt at Barr's house, I fear you got the wrong idea of me, for I've read enough in the papers now to know I'd been right all along to discipline that girl. And in fact, I think she could have benefited from a good beating, sire, for maybe then she wouldn't have gone on to cause such trouble."
"Wait, what girl?" said Miss Hooda, clearly forgetting her tacit agreement to be silent.
"You don't mean Aliza?" Kamran flinched.
"Indeed I do," Mrs. Amina said triumphantly. "I read the girl's name in the papers this morning, and I knew straight away when I saw it it seemed familiar. And then I remembered how I'd heard that awful girl tell her name to this boy," she pointed at Omid, "when he'd come to Barr's house to hand her a dratted invitation to the ball, and which I see now I was far too generous to allow. And after the way my dear mistress came home last night, all afright over the terrible tragedy, I told her, I said to her, as I brought her a cup of mint tea to soothe her nerves, I said, 'Well, how do you like that, milady? I've pieced it all together myself. The girl from the papers had worked here at Barr's house all that time.' And my mistress was ever so upset about the whole thing. I can't even describe her horror. For she'd begun thinking that you, sire, had known all along about the girl's deception and lied about it. For why else would you have defended her so ardently that day and again at the ball? But I assured her that the girl had likely bewitched you, Your Highness, and that you shouldn't be blamed for her wickedness."
"Mrs. Amina, that is quite enough. Forgive me," Dean said, frowning as he glanced around the group. "But were we brought in to be questioned about the same girl? The Jinn Snodda, who came to me for salve? If so, I cannot corroborate these stories, for I don't know her name, and I've no notion of her attending a ball or causing any kind of trouble."
"She was no ordinary Snodda," Mrs. Amina cried. "Don't you see? I'd long suspected there was something the matter with her. She was always putting on airs, speaking all the time like she was some kind of toff, and I only blame myself, sire, for not exposing her sooner. I felt the darkness in her the first day I saw her, and when I watched her eyes change colour right in front of me, I should have known she had the devil inside her."
"If anyone has the devil inside her," Omid said angrily, "it's you."
"Vile girl," Mrs. Amina was saying, ignoring this outburst from the boy.
"Never liked her. She never followed instructions, you know. Always sloppy with her work, cutting corners."
"Sloppy with her work?"
Dean cut her off, his eyes wide with shock.
"The girl who came into my shop with hands so destroyed by hard labour she could hardly make a fist?"
He shook his head, took a sharp step away from the woman. "You're the housekeeper who beat her, aren't you? Don't tell me you're responsible for that infected cut across her throat too."
"Oh no, sir," Omid said quietly in Ardans. "That was me."
Dean looked suddenly revolted.
"Who are you people? Pray tell me, what crimes have I committed to deserve the great misfortune of your company? I merely treated a girl for her wounds."
He looked beseechingly at the prince.
"Your Highness, will you not allow me to return home?
I've done no wrong here. I don't deserve to have my name lowered by association with these heathens.
Hold a moment, Kamran said, considering Dean closely. You can confirm that the girl's injuries were real, then? They weren't the result of an illusion.
An illusion?
Dean hesitated.
Your Highness, I can't imagine what reason she'd have to waste magic on torturing herself. But if for some inane purpose she'd managed to enchant her hands to ruin, I should think she'd have the ability to change them back. What need would she have of my salves if she could do such a thing on her own? No, sire. I don't believe her wounds were any kind of illusion.
The apothecarist frowned then, appearing to remember something.
She did, however, discover in my presence that her body was able to heal itself at a more rapid rate than was normal, and removed her bandages after only days instead of the week I'd suggested.
Heal itself,
Kamran repeated, going still.
Really? Yes, sire.
Dean blinked at him, surprised by the prince's interest.
Her skin recovered itself at a rather unnatural pace, which is not considered common, even among djinn.
A sign of the devil, Mrs. Amina cried. Here is proof. Oh, do shut up,
Miss Hooda said irritably.
You ignore the signs at your own peril, miss,
Mrs. Amina countered sharply.
Djinn can make themselves invisible, not blurry. And no one was able to get a good look at the girl last night, almost certainly on account of the devil's influence.
There are possibilities other than the devil, Miss Hooda shot back angrily.
The clothes she was wearing. Well, they'd been delivered with a note I couldn't read, but garments are all the time bewitched, particularly in battle, to offer their wearer anonymity or protection. And her blurriness might have been the work of a fairly straightforward magical enchantment.
Dark enchantments! Dark magic!
Mrs. Amina cried.
Everyone knows that dark magic cannot be born without the devil's interference.
This is utter rubbish,
said Dean, rolling his eyes.
If the girl had access to dark magic, do you really think she'd accept a pittance in exchange for scrubbing scum from your mistress's floors? You think if she had access to dark magic, that she'd willingly share a roof with a brutal housekeeper who clearly took pleasure in beating her? I should think not.
Mrs. Amina gasped in outrage, took a step back, and promptly lashed out at the apothecarist, who rallied with ease.
Kamran wanted to put an end to this madness, wanted to clear these clowns out of his home, but he discovered then, to his dismay, that he could not move. His pulse seemed to be pounding in his head, his heart beating violently against his chest. Bit by bit, he was being proven wrong about Aliza. Having now been personally subjected to Cyrus's manipulations of magic, Kamran could imagine that the southern king possessed the skills necessary to have imbued her garments with protections. Indeed, it would make sense if he'd magicked the gown to protect her identity from those who wished her harm. For what else might explain why so few people at the ball had been able to identify her? What else would explain Cyrus's cryptic statement, his subtle accusation that Kamran could see her? Aliza's gown had been incinerated twice as she entered and exited the fire. Perhaps in the process the frock had lost some of its effectiveness, blurring her from the crowd instead of blotting her out altogether. This might explain why Kamran's eyesight had failed him with such inconsistency, why she'd seemed to fade in and out of focus before him. As Aliza's betrayals were revealed, he'd swung wildly between hatred and longing, wanting at once to kill her and save her. The magic had perhaps reacted to his warring emotions. If Aliza had thought her identity was protected, this would explain, too, why she'd not felt the need to wear her snodder. It did not, however, explain why she'd physically assaulted the young man she'd allegedly agreed to marry. Kamran grit his teeth. He felt then the onslaught of a powerful headache, pain gripping the base of his skull. He didn't know what he felt most in the face of these reveals, anger or relief or confusion, perhaps some mixture of the three. For while on some level these answers exonerated Aliza, they also proved that she'd lied to him. She'd pretended not to know Cyrus while she was all the while allied with the Tulanian king. She'd accepted his help, his magic. She'd worn his gown. They'd had a plan. Kamran couldn't conquer the chasm of uncertainty yawning open under his feet, for there remained a great deal to doubt about Aliza, including her betrothal to Cyrus, her alliance with the devil, and her escape from the palace on the back of a Tulanian dragon. He felt at sea, drowning in doubt, and his frustration only intensified. This anger was directed toward himself, toward his grandfather, toward the circumstances that now defined his life. That King Zal had died at all had been reason enough for Kamran to rage, but it was the aftermath, he realized, that had broken him the most. For in the wake of his grandfather's murder, fear and grief had muddled the prince's otherwise inviolable instincts, causing him to question everything that had felt so certain only hours prior. Once again, his emotions had overruled him. Of all the trials ahead, Kamran was beginning to fear that his greatest obstacle would be overcoming himself. "Your Majesty," came Dean's sharp voice, returning the prince to the present. "I beg you, please dismiss me from this circus. I should have been home for dinner by now, and my loved ones will begin to fear for my safety."
"Loved ones," Mrs. Amina made a sound of contempt. "You've got loved ones, have you? While the rest of us must marry our work, warm our beds with pain, and give birth only to bitterness."
"Enough!"
Kamran practically roared. In 100 ways he'd been tested throughout his life, in battle and death and devastation. But there was something about being forced to stand still and listen to a pack of idiots speak nonsense in front of his face that made him want to self-immolate.
"I don't want to hear another word," he said in a deathly whisper, "from any of you."
The words died in his throat. An eerie wave of sensation flared along his tortured skin as his heart thundered in his chest, the sound of his own breathing intensifying in his ears. He turned slowly, expecting to see a diviner, and instead discovered Zahak, the slippery man slinking toward him now with a cloying smile. The defense minister came to a stop before him, clasping his hands as if in prayer.
"I thought I heard a commotion," he said,
taking in the broad details of the unfolding drama with no apparent interest. He returned his blank eyes to Kamran.
"I've been waiting for you all day, sire. Perhaps now we might finally speak."
Another tremor of sensation awoke along the prince's golden veins, just as three diviners drifted suddenly into view. 23. Cyrus wouldn't wake. Iblis had tortured him until long after darkness had shed its skin upon the sky. Aliza, who knew how to mark time with only her hands and the movements of the sun, had been able to estimate the time they'd lost, the hours Cyrus had been brutalized by the devil. The flower field which had been so colourful and ethereal in daylight, was rendered a vast lake of pitch in the night. Aliza did not know where they were. She did not know how to get back to the castle, and every time she closed her eyes for even a moment, she heard Cyrus screaming. For what had seemed an eternity, she'd watched him suffer. Bruises had bloomed and diminished all along his face, and, she had to assume, his body, where the bluish stains occasionally spread just beyond his collar or cuffs. But the lesions never lasted longer than a minute. His ribs never seemed to break, though he'd clutched them many times in agony. His skin revealed no lacerations, though he'd bled for hours. When Cyrus had finally stopped seizing, the moon stood high and bright in the sky, and Aliza had held on to this miracle of light like a lifeline, terrified she'd succumb to her own fears before he even awoke. Distraught, Aliza had drawn Cyrus's heavy head into her lap, assessing up close the evidence of his suffering. His face was nearly unrecognizable in such a grisly state, but his clothes and coat, at least, had absorbed most of the evening's bloodshed. The moon occasionally threw into stark relief the damp stains glimmering across his garments, provoking in her each time a new wave of heartache. She'd mopped the remaining blood from his face with the skirt of her white dress and used the wet of her own silent, unceasing tears to gently scrub the lingering stickiness from his eyes, his skin. Then, when none of this seemed to rouse him, she'd stroked his hair in careful, tender motions. Even then she marvelled at the thick silk of his copper locks, the way they gleamed in the moonlight. She'd begged him to wake. He did not stir. It had been at least 30 minutes since the creases between his brows had smoothed and his body had stabilised, during which time Aliza had lived with the terrifying likelihood that Cyrus might be dead. It shocked her to discover how much this possibility affected her. She should have rejoiced in his pain. She should have fled while he was unconscious. Instead, she astonished herself by remaining firmly by his side, fearing for him, pleading with him to open his eyes. These were feelings she did not wish to examine. With a fumbling effort, she'd discovered a weak pulse at his throat, giving her reason to hope, but alone in the expansive darkness, her imagination was unkind to her. Her memories replayed the last hours on a sickening loop, and the more she turned over the devil's savagery in her mind, the more she felt a spiralling trepidation, a fear of what was yet to come. Aliza wiped desperately at her tears. She watched Cyrus's closed eyes for any sign of life, but his rust-coloured lashes rested heavily, undisturbed. Only then, when she was feeling quite desperate, did she dare to touch her trembling fingers to his face, drawing her hand down the stunning softness of his cheek. When still he was unresponsive, her motions grew more assured, more intentional. She caressed him with great care, brushed the backs of her knuckles along the sharp line of his jaw, grazed the elegant slope of his nose. It was strange to see him so defenceless, his expression so unguarded. The harsh edges of his tense and stoic expressions were smoothed away in sleep, the planes of his face rendered milky in the starlight. She would never again deny that he was beautiful. She whispered to him over and over, beseeching him to return to his body, to this present moment, and was again stroking the curve of his cheek when he caught her hand weakly, and she went suddenly deathly still. Relief flooded through her even as her pulse sped up, for his fingers slowly closed around her own. He drew the back of her hand gently against his lips, and then, so softly she might have imagined it, he kissed her. Aliza's heart beat chaotically in her chest.
"Cyrus," she said, hating the broken sound of her voice. "Are you awake?"
He moved only a little, letting their clasped hands fall against his cheek. He did not let go. He did not open his eyes. He tore open his mouth with some difficulty, wetting his lips before he drew a deep breath. On an exhale, he said,
"No."
Aliza didn't know what to do. She felt a bit mortified to have been discovered petting him, and she was more than a little unbalanced by the tenderness of his kiss. She sat very, very still in the dark, too aware of their held hands resting against his cheek, and waited for Cyrus to shake off the last of his stupor. She hoped her pounding heart was not audible in the silence, though she feared that it was.
"Touch me," he whispered.
Her heart beat only harder.
"What?"
He released her hand, but only to press her open palm firmly against his face. For a moment his eyelashes fluttered, and then, quite contentedly, he sighed. Aliza realized with a shock that he was dreaming. She knew she had to wake him, that the hour was growing only later, that her fear of the dark was growing only more acute, that she would eventually freeze to death, even on this false summer night, and that, more important, they'd be missed. But she agonized over the decision, for he'd endured such brutality for so long, she didn't think she could bring herself to disturb what appeared to be a truly restful sleep. So she stalled. Cyrus appeared to be in some in-between state of alertness, aware enough for speech, but too dormant to know he straddled two worlds. She would wait a bit longer, she told herself, to see if he'd find consciousness on his own. Aliza didn't know why he'd fallen into such a strange stupor in the aftermath of his encounter with Iblis, but if Cyrus was still under the influence of dark magic, she worried forcing him to wake would end poorly. In the interim, Aliza gave in and did as he asked, caressing his face in careful, steady motions, occasionally drawing her hand over his hair, smoothing the strands away from his eyes. He soon made a soft, satisfied sound, so gentle and unaffected it made her chest ache. And then, like a child, he turned his head in her lap, sliding his hand up the inside of her naked thigh, like it might have been a pillow. Aliza nearly screamed. Earlier she'd tugged up the hem of her frock, for she'd used her skirt to mop up Cyrus's blood and had then knotted this heavily sullied hem in hopes of mitigating any further transfer of the red stain. And while, yes, she'd noticed that the dress had hitched above her knees, exposing several inches of bare skin beyond the lace trim of her stockings, she'd paid this small impropriety no mind, for the possible exposure of her thighs in almost perfect darkness had been the least of her concerns 30 minutes prior, when she'd thought Cyrus was dead. Now she could hardly breathe. His hand was warm and heavy. His fingers splayed possessively across the innermost expanse of her upper leg. And worse, they were dangerously close to skimming the seam of her undergarments. Already the weight of his touch in so intimate a place had left her feeling a bit faint. If his hand moved even a little higher, she feared she might actually scream. His head, at least, was holding her dress quite firmly in place, a fact she took comfort in remembering. But she didn't know what to do. If she were to fling his hand off her leg, she would almost certainly and jarringly wake him. She'd not hesitate to do so under any other circumstance, but she still lacked the conviction to disturb him any further on so difficult a night. And worse, she didn't know what would happen if she did. He exhaled heavily in his sleep then, his warm breath grazing her already sensitive skin. And Aliza nearly whimpered. She was breathing too fast, alternately wondering whether she shouldn't just wake him and be done with it, and whether she might not be overreacting altogether. He was sleeping, after all. He'd not meant to touch her like this. In fact, she knew him well enough by now to speculate that if he'd any idea his hand was right now resting in such a scandalous place under her skirt, he'd be horrified. He only needed a little rest, she reasoned. Perhaps if his hand stayed exactly where it was, things might turn out just fine. So when moments later he shifted an inch and his hand moved farther up her thigh, she nearly bit through her tongue to keep from making a sound. His fingers had much more than grazed the silky edge of her underwear, and Aliza thought she might expire. "Cyrus," she said, panicking. "Please wake up." He said nothing. "Cyrus?"
"Yes."
Her heart was beating too hard. Are you awake now? Please tell me you're awake." When, after a long beat, he didn't answer, she knew she had to do something. She couldn't sit here in the dark with the heat of his touch searing her. She feared the inside of her head would catch fire. Carefully, she hitched her skirt up a bit higher and prized his wandering hand off her thigh. But she'd hardly breathed a sigh of relief before her fears came at once to fruition. The abrupt motion startled him, and he immediately sat straight up with a gasp, looked around himself in an unsteady motion, and met her eyes. Even in the moonlight, she could tell he was disoriented. "Cyrus," she said, overcome with relief. "You're awake."
"Aliza," he whispered, exhaustion weakening his voice. "What are you doing here?"
"What do you mean?" she tensed. "We're in the flower field, remember?"
"No,"
he said, and he seemed to lose steam all at once, his head beginning to droop.
"How did you—"
he blinked very slowly.
"How'd you get in my room? You're not supposed to be here."
Aliza's relief became alarm. "We're not in your room," she said, fighting back her panic. "It's just that the sun has gone down, and it's very dark now. And cold, actually. So, if you wouldn't mind taking us back—"
"I'm so tired, Aliza,"
he said, stumbling over the words. He sounded delirious.
"Let's go back to bed, Aliza."
"Cyrus," he laughed a little, like he was drunk.
"I do say it a lot."
"What?" she said, going briefly still.
"Your name,"
he said, and closed his eyes. He nearly fell over, catching himself at the last second.
"I didn't know your name for so long, Angel. I love the way it feels in my mouth."
Aliza's confusion was outweighed by the physical shock she felt at his casual affection, the endearment embedding in her chest, causing chaos. "Cyrus," she said, feeling suddenly close to tears. "What's happening to you? Are you sick?"
"Oh, yes,"
he nodded.
"It's terrible."
"Is it magic?" Her fears ratcheted only higher. "Are you under a spell right now?"
"Yes. Always happens," he murmured. "Part of the cycle."
"What always happens?" she asked urgently. "What cycle? What are you talking about?" He didn't respond. Instead, he clapped a heavy hand against his cheek and frowned.
"Did you wash my face, sweetheart?"
A new tenderness, another blow to her chest. "Yes," she whispered.
"How?"
His hand fell away, and he squinted into the darkness.
"Did you call for a maid?"
"No." Her head felt strange, overheated. This time when he swayed, he fell. Aliza caught him with a soft oof, and his head landed with a gentle thud against her chest, where without the heft of her golden necklace, the low neckline of her bodice was nearly indecent. Cyrus turned his head, pressed his face to the exposed skin of her breasts, and made a sound deep in his throat, something like a groan.
"You're so soft," he said, slurring the words. "So sweet."
Aliza worked desperately to compartmentalize the torrent of sensation awakening in her body. Something was very, very wrong.
"You feel so real," he whispered.
"Cyrus," she said, "you're frightening me." He shook his head and took a deep, shuddering breath, unself-consciously inhaling the scent of her.
"Don't be afraid of me, Angel. I won't hurt you. I'll never hurt you."
Aliza's chest constricted, her heart frantic. He was a ton of dead weight, so heavy she didn't know how to get his head off her chest without shoving him to the ground. "Listen, I know you're very tired," she said nervously, "but I need your help, sleepy boy. Can you do something for me?"
"Anything."
He drew his nose along the swell of her breasts, kissing the smooth skin there once, twice, until she made a desperate broken sound and he swore low under his breath.
"Aliza," he said, sounding drugged, "can I taste you?"
She was shaking so hard, the tremors were beyond her control now. And if Cyrus weren't half out of his mind, she'd have been too mortified to speak. Her breath was coming in fast, in fits. She had to get herself in order, or else she'd lose this struggle entirely. "Listen to me," she said breathlessly. "I need you to get us back to the castle. Can you please do that for me, Cyrus? Can you use a bit of magic to return us to the palace?"
He said softly. "Yes. Back to bed. Warmer there."
"No," she hastened to say. "Not back to bed. No bed. Just the castle." Aliza bit back a shriek. She went briefly weightless as the scene blurred, sounds merged, her stomach dropped, and she fell hard onto something soft and dense. The sound of crickets gave way to silence. The chilly darkness, replaced by pools of warm, dim light that illuminated the shapes and contours of lush, decadent quarters she had to assume belonged to Cyrus. And if this was his room, then she was lying on his bed. 24. For stretches at a time, Kamran would forget that his appearance had altered. He'd forget that his face was disfigured, that his eyes were different colours. He'd never been so vain as to linger before a looking glass, or even to catch a glimpse of himself in a reflective window. For of all the things he admired most about himself, his physicality was low on the list. Then again, he'd never had to care. He'd taken for granted his good looks. He'd long witnessed the effect he had on others, the way dilated eyes betrayed baser thoughts in his presence, the way young women trembled when he stood close enough. Kamran, like many people, was not insensible to a certain energy. He could feel a person's desire. He could also feel their loathing. Zahak's animosity seemed to heat the air around them, even as the minister smiled, his black eyes batting like the wings of a beetle, opening to reveal repellent insides for all of a moment, before shuttering closed. Zahak made no secret of his interest in Kamran's transformed face. tracking with morbid fascination the glimmering fractured lines that disappeared into his collar.
"Are you quite well, sire?"
he said, feigning concern.
"You appear to be in a great deal of pain."
Kamran was careful to keep his expression impassive, even as the statement surprised him. He was not, in fact, in pain. This registered as a shock, for aside from the occasional discomfort he now experienced at the sound of Aliza's name and the odd hum he felt in the presence of the diviners, the sharp electric torment he'd more recently been suffering, the pain he'd for days ascribed to the discomfort of his clothing, had altogether subsided in the wake of his physical transformation. It was, in fact, the very lack of discomfort that kept him from remembering his new, grisly appearance. He did not feel tremendously altered. With a start, he remembered what Aliza had said to him on the night of the ball, how she'd suspected, as his body had sustained wave after wave of torment, that he might have had an aversion to gold. She'd suggested as a result that he cease wearing clothing woven with the glittering thread. It had been an interesting observation, for the gilded stripe that once neatly bisected his chest and torso had all but shattered across his body in an almost reactive manner. But as he adjusted his sleeves then, stalling as he turned Zahark's words over in his mind, he was reminded that even his mourning clothes glimmered in places with strands forged from the precious metal. In that regard, nothing had changed. His attire, designed and fashioned months prior, had not been relieved of its decorative gold work. The glimmering raised embroidery iconic of his royal garb could be found along the ruffs, cuffs, and shoulders of nearly all he owned. He struggled then to remember the first incident of this specific physical discomfort, and the memory found him with the force of a shock, his mother slapping his hand away from his collar, telling him to cease scratching at his neck like a dog, him complaining that they couldn't find a capable seamstress in all the empire. But then, that wasn't entirely fair, for Kamran could not recall ever having such an issue with his garments prior to that morning. The morning he'd met Aliza for the first time. All this he processed in but a matter of seconds. And as he lifted his eyes to meet Zahak's beady gaze, a strange hypothesis had begun forming in his mind.
"I'm quite well," the prince said, finally answering the minister's question. "Though I thank you for your concern."
Zahak hesitated, surprise widening his eyes before he clasped his hands, rearranging his expression. It occurred to Kamran only then that he'd likely never thanked Zahak for anything.
"I've come to you now on a matter of great import," Zahak said briskly. "In the wake of all this terrible, terrible tragedy, the nobles and I had resolved, among other things, to restore the magical protections of the empire with all possible haste. We assembled early this morning to issue a series of urgent summons to diviners across Ardunia, but found our actions were redundant, for the esteemed priests and priestesses had begun delivering themselves to the palace before our messengers had even mounted their horses. They've been appearing at intervals all day, you see, having already foreseen the darkness befalling Setar."
"Minister," Kamran said sharply, sparing a glance at his four wide-eyed onlookers. "As you can plainly see, we have the distinct displeasure of an unexpected audience tonight. Perhaps this discussion should wait for another time."
"I gave you multiple opportunities, sire, to have this conversation in private, but you ignored my every request. I've no choice now but to beseech you where we stand."
Kamran went briefly lightheaded with rage.
"Get out!"
he said, spinning around to face his unwanted crowd. Go home, all of you, now!
Forgive me, Your Majesty, said Dean, holding up one finger, for I would love nothing more than to leave, but I should require a carriage, for our hackney is long gone, and it isn't possible to hail a hansom cab from the palace.
Out! Kamran shouted, pointing at the door. Get out and walk home, for all I care.
Walk? Miss Hooda gasped. But it's at least half a mile just across the bridge, sire, and it's terribly dark and cold outside.
And there was a mob, Mrs. Amina cried. We might be set upon by bandits.
Kamran dragged a hand down his face and cursed himself, his life, and this godforsaken troop of half-wits he'd never have known were it not for Aliza, who'd so thoroughly transfixed him and so completely possessed him that he'd failed to notice she counted among her allies a murderous street child, a priggish apothecarist, an illegitimate miss, the demented king of Tulan, and possibly the devil himself. Oh, he felt he was living through a surrealist nightmare.
Zahak cleared his throat.
Sire, I know you are benevolent enough to understand the urgency of the situation. Perhaps you will not object to accompanying me now to more private quarters, for the diviners have requested to meet with you at once. We cannot delay any further.
Kamran felt his blood pressure spike. He wasn't meant to deal with this right now. He was meant to have carried the crates of supplies down to the dock. He was meant to have packed a satchel of essential goods for his journey. He was meant to have finished preparing for a swift escape, not be curtailed by a team of imbeciles, cornered by Zahak, or reduced to ash by the diviners.
I've no doubt, Kamran said firmly, that you can appreciate how much I've had to do, as you put it, in the wake of all this tragedy. And as I'm currently quite preoccupied, I'd prefer to meet with the diviners tomorrow. He offered a terse nod to the trio of priests, standing silently to the side. When my mind is better rested.
Zahak's expression darkened a shade.
I'm afraid I cannot put them off any longer, sire. We have a new quorum assembled now, and they're ready to perform what they've deemed to be a critical ceremony. One that cannot under any circumstances wait another moment.
Now, Kamran glowered. He'd known this betrayal was coming, and still he struggled to restrain his anger.
A critical ceremony, he repeated. A critical ceremony for what purpose, pray?
Once more, Zahak's eyes lingered on the glittering striations upon Kamran's face.
Surely you will wish to do whatever is best for the Empire, he said, baring his teeth in a smile. The diviners only want to be certain. They bound this magic to your body at birth, with a power that was designed never to be undone. There's no precedent for such a marking to mutate in this way, or for a body to reject it. You cannot be surprised by their interest.
Kamran became suddenly aware of a presence behind him, an impulse pricking, alerting him to danger. He turned his head only halfway, spotting out of the corner of his eye the approach of the three diviners, though how they managed to change positions so quickly, Kamran couldn't imagine. He turned his gaze to the ground, struggled to remain calm.
You intend to take me by force? During these dark times, Zahak said silkily, it is of the utmost importance that we pledge our allegiance only to the true sovereign of our dunya, else we cannot be certain to emerge victorious. Surely you can understand this.
Kamran heard someone gasp at that, and was reminded, as renewed anger tore through him, of his unwanted onlookers.
Very well.
If Zahak was going to intentionally humiliate him in front of an audience, Kamran would return the favor in full.
I understand, the prince said darkly. Only that you've been eager to undermine me from the moment my father was murdered. You expected my grandfather to keel over shortly thereafter, didn't you? He was over 100 years old. His death must have seemed inevitable. But my grandfather lived too long, didn't he? Just long enough to give me time to ascend the throne at a suitable age.
Kamran watched the older man stiffen and took a careful step forward.
It must have been frustrating for you to see him live, he went on. For had both my father and my grandfather died in quick succession, I might have been crowned king as a mere child, which would have been a perfect storm of tragedies for a power-hungry man like yourself. I offer you my sympathies, the prince said coldly. It must have been a blow indeed to have lost an opportunity to rule as regent.
Zahak's nostrils flared, his anger surfacing only briefly before he regained control. Still, he spoke in an uncharacteristic rush when he said,
I've worked for this empire since before even your mother was born, sire. And to note the disparity between my 60 years and your 18 would be to comment on the difference between a mountain and a grain of sand.
He too took a step closer.
That you lack the intelligence and experience necessary to rule our dunya is a generous understatement. There is no sense in allowing a child to inherit the greatest empire in the world simply by order of birth. And I will not scruple to say that I resent the reward you were dealt for the mere effort of being born, a feat accomplished by millions of others who live and breathe today. Your grandfather, on the other hand, was a great man and a great king, and I was proud to serve under him. But he destroyed his entire legacy by appealing in a moment of weakness to the most detested creature alive. Nearly a century he ruled our land, and now he will be remembered with only hatred and disgust. Yes.
Zahak's eyes glittered with menace.
Your grandfather lived too long, and I can only hope he hasn't instilled the same terrible values in his grandson.
Kamran felt his chest heave with fury.
Our king is dead less than a day, he said, his voice rising an octave. And you dare to speak of him with such vitriol?
Zahak narrowed his eyes.
That you still hold him in such high regard is damning indeed, sire.
It is a comfort to me, Kamran said quietly, to know that I was always right to loathe you.
As it is a comfort to me, the minister countered, to know that you will soon be returned to your truest form. Bereft of a crown, you are little more than a spoiled child, unseasoned and ill-informed and altogether undeserving of the throne.
Unexpectedly, Kamran smiled. You take a great risk by voicing aloud your truths, minister. With every word you put forth, you walk yourself closer to your own funeral. Has it not occurred to you, he said quietly, to fear for the possibility that my crown remains firmly fixed upon my head? Zahak swallowed, his jaw clenching.
Seize him, he said.
Kamran had hardly opened his mouth to speak before his lips were sealed shut, his legs pinned together, and his arms bolted to his sides. His mind screamed in protest as he struggled uselessly against his magical binds, his eyes darting back and forth in a terrible panic. Alarm bloomed through his body, awakening inside him simultaneous fear and rage. For the second time in less than a day he was paralyzed, though this time at the hands of the diviners, the priests and priestesses who'd always loved and protected him, and upon whom Kamran had relied all his life. This latest blow of another savage betrayal rattled him to his core. He went suddenly weightless. The prince felt, more than saw, that he hung in the air, experiencing a strange emotional and physical detachment as his body was shuttled through space. He thought he heard a familiar, insistent buzzing sound, but then came the clamour of voices, a thunder of shouts and cries, and the din faded into nothing as he was forced, floating and paralysed, from the room.